The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights. Whether that's live music at a historic venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect. Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
You're listening to the Quince Podcast.
It's day 36 of the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, and a lot has happened in just this past week. From Russia and Ukraine coming to the negotiation table in Istanbul to Russia announcing for the first time that it will be reducing military presence in Kiev and surrounding regions to Ukraine pitching the idea of declaring itself a neutral nation to end the war. While the peace talks have offered a glimmer of hope, there have been no breakthroughs yet. The two nations at war, however, have decided to resume peace talks from 1st April. Over the past month, we have seen how the severe sanctions slapped on Russia has affected not only its own economy, but the world. Price of crude oil and natural gas has been spiking almost daily, and we in India can also feel this impact. In the past 10 days, the price of petrol and diesel has increased 9 times in India. While India has supported calls for a ceasefire and a diplomatic solution, it has so far abstained from every vote for draft resolutions condemning Russia. This fence-sitting has also led to a growing unease on the diplomatic front for India, with Germany, Australia and the US critiquing India for its stance. What may have made matters worse is the two-day visit of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to New Delhi on 31st March. The agenda of this visit is not public yet, but it does put India in a tricky position, especially with the fellow Quad countries. So in today's episode, we go through the recent developments in the ongoing war and what they signify. Joining me today to unpack this is our regular guest and a friend of the show, Professor Harsh V. Pant, the Director of Strategic Studies at the Observer Research Foundation. You're tuned in to The Big Story, the podcast where we dissect the headline-making news for you, and I'm your host, Himmat. Let's start with the big news, which is Russia and Ukraine coming to the negotiation table in Istanbul on 29th March. Ahead of the talks, Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky continued to insist on the quote-unquote sovereign and territorial integrity of his country and that the effective guarantees to ensure the same are mandatory. However, according to an Al Jazeera report, his tone changed when speaking to Russian journalists, where he stated that he is willing to compromise over the status of the eastern Donbass region as part of a peace deal. He reportedly said, and I quote, "Security guarantees and neutrality, non-nuclear status of our state, we are ready to go for it." And this is exactly what Ukraine brought to the table in Istanbul as well, where it gave a detailed plan for becoming a neutral country. So what exactly does being a neutral country entail? Well, as you may know, there are a few neutral countries like Switzerland and Sweden who have historically never participated in any wars. And that is the main component of being a neutral country. You can't engage in a war, you can't enter military alliances, nor send military aid to any country which is part of a war. You also can't provide your territory, neither land or sea, to harbor any armament of a belligerent. And this is not the first time Ukraine has become neutral. In fact, achieving a neutral status is part of Ukraine's constitution, and it was one until 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea. Now, for Ukraine, neutrality would mean that it has to give up its desire to join NATO or any other military alliances as well. But is this the best way forward for Ukraine to end this war? And if Ukraine does become neutral, will Russia respect its new status? We took this question to Professor Harsh Pant, the Director and Head of Strategic Studies at the Observer Research Foundation. According to him, while neutrality may give Russia an option to save face in this war, it is a delicate question for Ukraine and would require strong legally binding guarantees from all stakeholders in this conflict.
I think the contours of that neutrality, as President Zelensky is saying, will have to be formally guaranteed. So I don't think, I think there is a recognition in Ukraine that, neutrality in and of itself is not the solution to this problem. And while this will give Russia a means to, save Russia's, face and come to the diplomatic, conclusion to a certain degree, but from Ukrainian perspective, This would require more than just framing it in neutrality terms. It would also mean that all the stakeholders would have to guarantee that Ukraine will be will remain an independent and sovereign nation state. And I think they are saying this because they are not really sure of Russian commitments in the future. Mm-hmm. I think the challenge would be that from the perspective of Ukraine, that so long as Mr. Putin is in office, his desire to see the historical wrongs, what he perceives rectified, would mm-hmm. mean that any independent streak by Ukraine would be resisted. So mm-hmm. I think for Ukraine, it's going to be a very delicate question of how far they can go with this idea of neutrality. Mm-hmm. But certainly, I think they are putting it out there in the front so that at least it can begin that conversation forward. But as you can see, they are also talking about this neutrality being guaranteed by the other stakeholders.
Speaking of Russia's saving face, there are a few signs that it may be reconsidering its options in this war. As the peace talks commenced on 29 March, Russia also announced that it has decided to withdraw Russian forces from near Kiev and Chernihiv to, quote-unquote, increase mutual trust at the peace talks. However, our listeners should note that the shelling in both these cities continued even after this statement. And the statement of reduction of Russian troops also needs to be taken with a grain of salt, according to a Guardian report. The report states that while some movement of troops from the north towards Belarus has been detected, this appears to be part of a normal operation of redeployment. More so, Zelensky in a statement on the same day also noted that, quote-unquote, Ukrainians are not naive people, and that after 34 days of invasion, the only thing they can trust is a concrete result. But this move to reduce troops around Kiev is also worrying, according to a British Ministry of Defense statement. The statement reads, and I quote, "It is highly likely that Russia will seek to divert combat power from the north to the offensive in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions in the east," end quote. According to Professor Pant, it is too early to state what this move exactly means, but that it is in Russia's interest to pull back the focus to Donetsk and Luhansk as originally planned to offer credible deliverables to Putin.
Well, I think it suggests two things. One is that there is a need to regroup and there is a need to refocus their energies on some credible deliverables. And I think Donetsk and Luhansk are the areas where they would like now to focus. I think they've seen that expanding it to whole of Ukraine is not giving them any advantage. And they need to focus and they need to regroup and they need to get back to the basics. Mm-hmm. But it also, I think, is something a bit too early to say that they would reduce the air campaign or they would. I think Ukrainians have said that they don't believe what the Russians are saying. Mm-hmm. That they don't expect any lowering of the guard from Russia. They do not expect any reduction in bombing. They don't expect any reduction in violence. So I think this can also be something that is for public consumption. That look, we are willing to give peace a chance. We are willing to give diplomacy a chance, especially at a time when the negotiations have just started. And let's see how far those negotiations go. I mean, unfortunately, negotiations have not gone anywhere. I think we have had a statement from the Russians themselves saying that they are not very hopeful about the negotiations. So I think it's a question of also shaping the public narrative, because the public narrative has gone against Russia. My sense would be that I would not read too much into this statement at this juncture unless there's something dramatically over a sustained period. We see a reduction in air campaign.
Yeah.
Over a sustained period, we see a decline in fatality in violence. In hostility. I think unless that happens, it would be in my own sense, would be overestimating what Russians are trying to convey.
And Putin himself, according to US and EU officials, has been quote-unquote misinformed about the reality of the war and how the Russian army is performing in this war. The White House on 38 March in a statement said that, quote-unquote, "We believe that Putin is being misinformed by his advisors about how badly the Russian military is performing and how the Russian economy is being crippled by the sanctions because his senior advisors are too afraid to tell him the truth," end quote. The same assessment was also made by Sir Jeremy Fleming, the top boss of the British spy agency GCHQ. In a speech in Australia on 30th March, he stated that, quote-unquote, "It's become his," meaning Putin's, "personal war, with this cost being paid by innocent people in Ukraine and increasingly by ordinary Russians too," end quote. The Kremlin so far has not responded to any of these assessments, but its silence does pose the following question. Given Putin's influence and power over the Russian army and the country itself, is it possible that he's being placed in the dark? According to Professor Pant, it's not surprising that such assessments are being made since Putin has potentially surrounded himself with yes-men. However, he adds that an independent assessment needs to be made on Putin's tactics so far.
You know, it tends to happen often. It's not surprising if this is happening. Of course, you know, this, mm-hmm. this is these are intelligence assessments from countries which are largely adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take it with that. When you are making an independent assessment, you have to be very clear in your mind that this is not an independent assessment.
Mm.
But I think what this points out to a syndrome which often happens to leaders who are who are this powerful, who are authoritarian, who tend to often get removed from the nitty-gritty of operational realities.
So
you end up living in a world where your word is the last word. And you end up in a system where your closest advisors are also those who either think like you or are forced to think like you, right?
Mm.
So a classic group think that you will you will, because you do not like dissent, you surround yourself with people who are basically yes men who speak a language that you like, and therefore you have no independent way of assessing what perhaps may be the ground realities. So I think if this is happening, Mr. Putin won't be the first leader of this kind, because this is quite prevalent. But certainly I think there is that, you know, if you look at some of the intelligence in the public domain at the moment, not particularly influenced by a political agenda. There is enough intelligence to suggest that certain things have happened which cannot be denied. The Russian military has underperformed. They have really not delivered on the ground after more than a month of fighting. Actually, they are struggling to even retain control of the ground that they had captured. And Ukrainians have done much better than many were expecting. A few Russian top leaders have died. Russian defense inventory has been tackled effectively by the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
So certain things have happened. Now, if you are looking at it from a military strategic point of view, you would certainly conclude that it has been a military disaster for Russia.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, given the disparity between Russia and Ukraine, it was never a contest. But
mm-hmm.
every day that Ukraine stands, Ukraine is making it very clear that it has become a contest.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a defeat for Russians. The whole public perception of Russian military as being this giant behemoth, Russian military being modernized, I think all those assumptions will have to be reassessed. So I think certain things have happened, and which will lead you to conclude that certainly the kind of military planning that should have gone into this operation did not go into this operation. So somewhere there is a question of accountability, and of course one of the reasons that you can attribute this to is to the fact that most people would be reluctant to tell Mr. Putin that this is a bad idea to go ahead with.
In just over 5 weeks, this war and the sanctions which followed it against Russia has made a significant dent in the world economy. The sanctions and dramatic rise in crude oil prices also resulted in the UN Conference on Trade and Development downgrading its global economic growth projections in its 2022 report to 2.6% from 3.6%. The slowdowns are not only expected in Russia due to the sanctions, but also in parts of Western Europe and across Asia. And it has also hit home in India. While the centre in its recent budget forecasted the economy to grow at 6.7% this year, the UN has slid this projection to 4.6%. Now, on the diplomatic front, it's been quite busy for India in the past few weeks. India has been facing pushback for its middle ground stance on the war so far, and navigating this neutral stance became all the more tricky after visits from both the Chinese and Russian foreign ministers to India. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will be visiting India till 1st April. Though the agenda is not known, media reports point out that it will be to discuss the rupee-ruble payments amid sanctions and the updates on the arms agreements. During Lavrov's visit, India is also hosting the US Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economics, Daleep Singh. And Lavrov's visit to India has already invited criticism. Daleep Singh, during his visit, cautioned India against expecting Russia to come to the country's defense if China were to violate the LAC, since Moscow and Beijing are now in a quote-unquote no-limits partnership. Now, given this, should India change its stance given the escalating conflict and the pushback received from other countries? Is it in India's best interest to continue relations with Russia? Professor Pant weighs in.
See, I think when you say most of the world has stepped away, I don't, I'm not so sure what kind of stepping away it is. I mean, see, most of the Europeans are still dealing with Russia. They are still buying oil from Russia. They are still, I mean, they have said that they are planning to reduce it over the next few months. But as of now, the purchase of oil, the purchase of gas continues. They are saying that, for example, Germany has said to its citizens that there is a possibility of shortage because the Russians want payments and we can't make those payments. They want payments in rubles. We only want to make payments in euros. So I think, the transactions are continuing for much of the world. Of course, they are being reduced. Of course, Europe has learned its lessons, or Europe is going to reduce its dependence. But as of now, they continue with it. So I don't think that Indians are particularly alone in that sense. What India is, of course, doing is also trying to find a way to make the payments for what it already purchased, what has already been purchased from Russia. So you have to work out a rupee-ruble arrangement, right? Because the traditional banking format is not working. Russians have offered an alternative to SWIFT to Russia. So I think India is really not that alone. And I think for India, and you do see a certain acceptance of that logic today, even when you hear statements, that from the Western capitals. Now, a lot of the Western leaders are also visiting India. You have German National Security Advisor visiting India. You have British Foreign Secretary in India. You have U.S. Deputy MSA in India. So they are also in India. And I think all of them are telling India that eventually, it might be a good idea to reduce dependence. And India is listening. But the issue is that the kind of dependence that India has in particular, which is defense dependence. If Europeans are finding it so difficult to reduce oil and gas dependence on Russia, you can imagine a situation for India, which is defense. Defense dependence is not something that happens in a jiffy. It requires decades. So I don't think, and I think that's a point that India has made to its interlocutors, Western interlocutors, and there is a fair degree of acceptance of the logic of this arrangement. That India will certainly, India has certain problems. India has issues with its defense engagements with Russia, and that is not something that India is going to go ahead and do in a matter of days. Now, having said that, India has also evolved its position. India's position today, if you see, for example, the British Prime Minister and Indian Prime Minister talking, both of them in their joint statement said that Russia should follow UN Charter. Now, this is one of the strongest statements from India vis-a-vis Russia, that that India is now framing its approach vis-a-vis Russia in normative terms, in terms that India recognizes are going to be very, very crucial when it comes to the Indo-Pacific. Whatever many in India might say that, what is happening in Europe has no bearing on Indo-Pacific. The fact is that the normative principles that India pushes in the Indo-Pacific, territorial integrity, sovereignty, rules-based order, they will be, you have to live up to them even in other theaters. And so you see that shift happening in Indian position, where India is now increasingly talking of sovereignty, territorial integrity, UN Charter, international law, and I think that is a shift in India's position vis-a-vis Russia. India will not publicly condemn Russia. India will not say that sanctions against Russia are needed. India will not isolate Russia, but I think India will certainly push on the question of on the framing of this issue. And that is, I think, a conversation that perhaps India will also have with Mr. Lavrov during his visit over the next few days.
For more updates on this ongoing conflict, head over to the Quinn's website. And if you're not already, subscribe to the Big Story podcast. you like listening to this episode, please subscribe to The Big Story for episodic updates. We're available on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, JioSaavn, and most of the other popular podcast streaming platforms. For other podcasts, please log on to the Quint website. And for any feedback, please shoot an email to podcast@thequint.com.
Thanks for listening. Log on to the Quint website and check out our other podcasts.